From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! At least 140 people have been killed over the past 2 days in Iraq following the bombing of one of the country's main Shiite shrines. We'll go to Baghdad for a report and speak with an Iraqi blogger. Then Republican Congress member Joe Barton of Texas has launched an investigation into one of the world's major oil companies, Citgo. The Venezuelan-owned company announced a discounted gas program for poor Americans last year. We'll speak with New York Congress member Jose Serrano. And the political firestorm continues in Washington over the proposed sale of 6 U.S. ports to a Dubai-owned company. Dubai is a key U.S. ally in the occupation of Iraq. Finally, Danny Schechter, the news dissector, on why anti-war activists should become media activists. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Iraq is under a high security alert following days of violence sparked by Wednesday's bombing of one of the country's holiest Shiite shrines in Samarra. At least 140 people, mostly Sunni Arabs, have been killed across the country. The Sunni-led Association of Muslim Scholars has said 184 Sunni mosques have since been damaged or destroyed. 10 clerics have been killed, 15 more abducted. The government imposed a rare daytime curfew today in Baghdad and in three other provinces, preventing many from attending Friday prayer. A series of joint Sunni-Shiite demonstrations have been held calling for national unity and to condemn the increasing violence. As many as 10,000 rallied in Basra alone, but many analysts fear Iraq is on the brink of civil war. The U.S. military is ordering its soldiers to stay in its barracks in Baghdad and to stay off the streets. On Thursday, 7 U.S. troops died. Meanwhile, the staff of the satellite TV channel Al Arabiya is in mourning following the death of one of its best-known correspondents in Iraq. The 30-year-old Atwar Bajat was assassinated along with her cameraman and soundman on Thursday. She had previously worked for Al Jazeera. A United Arab Emirates company has offered to delay its takeover of operations at 6 U.S. ports following political outcry over the deal in Washington. The state-controlled firm, Dubai Ports World, said it would not yet exercise control over the ports due to the controversy. President Bush has backed the deal, but it has been widely criticized by Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. On Thursday, Democrats, saying they were concerned for national security, called for a 45-day investigation into the deal that would put the Dubai-based company in charge of six of the nation's largest seaports: Baltimore, Philadelphia, Miami, New Orleans, New York, and Newark, New Jersey. Critics of the deal have noted that the UAE was the birthplace of two of the September 11th hijackers and that it was one of the only three countries to ever recognize the Taliban as Afghanistan's legitimate rulers. But on Thursday, Deputy Defense Secretary Gordon England defended the deal, saying the United Arab Emirates is now an ally of the United States. Companies from China, Denmark, Japan, Singapore, and Taiwan already run docks here in the U.S. The Financial Times is reporting an intelligence wing of the Marines has hired a private defense contractor to conduct a secret study of Iran's ethnic minorities. This is a move that could indicate early stages of contingency plans for a ground assault on Iran. The Marines conducted a similar study in Iraq. A former intelligence officer said the ultimate purpose of the Marines intelligence wing was to, quote, support effective ground military operations by the Marine Corps. The study appeared to focus on whether Iran would be prone to a violent fragmentation along the same kind of fault lines that are splitting Iraq. The Financial Times reports several Iranians living in the United States refused to help with the study because they saw it as part of an effort to break up Iran. To conduct the analysis, the military hired a subsidiary of the defense contractor SAIC, the Science Applications International Corporation. In news on Hurricane Katrina, the Natural Resources Defense Council is warning the soil and air around New Orleans still contains dangerously high levels of contaminants. According to the group, floodwaters from the hurricane deposited arsenic, lead, and petrochemical compounds across the region in amounts that are potentially dangerous to human health. The watchdog group is urging the state and federal government to clean up the waste before permitting young children to return to the city. The Bolivian government is protesting a decision by the United States to block a close confidant of newly elected President Evo Morales from visiting Bolivia, from visiting the United States. The woman's name is Leonida Zurita. She's a leader among Bolivia's peasants and coca farmers. The State Department said her visa was revoked after the U.S. government received, quote, information about her. On Thursday, Zurita spoke to reporters in Bolivia.
When I deposited my tickets, my passport, and the suitcase I was carrying, American Airlines told me, you cannot travel. It is an order of the U.S. ambassador. The letter that was presented to me mentioned some articles and said I could be associated with terrorism. I said if I was a terrorist, then I should be in jail.
Earlier in the week, it was revealed that the U.S. government has also been blocking an indigenous Bolivian professor named Huascar Ari from entering the United States in order to teach at the University of Nebraska. A federal judge has ordered the Bush administration to release the names of all the detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay. Up until now, only a handful of the prisoners have been officially identified. The ruling comes as the Bush administration is coming under increasing international pressure to close the prison camp. Meanwhile, newly released FBI memos show that FBI agents repeatedly warned military interrogators at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, that their aggressive methods were legally risky and also likely to be ineffective. The memos indicate senior military officials, including former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, were aware of and in some cases had approved of putting hoods on prisoners, threatening them with violence and subjecting them to humiliating treatment. In the Philippines, President Gloria Arroyo has declared a state of emergency just days ahead of the 20th anniversary of the fall of former President Ferdinand Marcos. The military said it had foiled a coup plot. Earlier today, thousands of protesters defied the state of emergency and rallied in the streets. Police responded by beating demonstrators and firing water cannons into the crowd. Schools have been closed around the country and military checkpoints have been set up around Manila. In Ecuador, protests targeting the country's oil industry have ended after the government agreed to spend millions of dollars on social programs in the impoverished but oil-rich province of Napo. The protests began Monday as Napo residents seized a major oil production site. On Tuesday, demonstrators shut down two pipelines and briefly kidnapped 24 oil workers. To stop the protests, the government sent in hundreds of troops and arrested two mayors and a legislator. The protesters have long complained the federal government was profiting from the region's oil, but neglected to finance projects that benefited residents, including roads, bridges, and airports. In news on Haiti, President Bush has spoken for the first time with newly elected President René Préval. According to the White House, Bush congratulated Préval on his victory and discussed Haiti's cooperation in the so-called war on drugs. But tension already seems to be mounting between the U.S. and the new government over whether former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide should be allowed to return. Aristide was ousted in a U.S.-backed coup 2 years ago. Aristide announced his intention to return from South Africa, where he is in exile, earlier this week.
The date of my return will emerge from consultation, as President Mbeki and Minister Zuma already said it. So when it's concluded, you will know.
Have you spoken?
That was former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The Préval government has indicated Aristide will be able to return, but the Bush administration has said Aristide's return would serve no useful purpose. State Department spokesperson Adam Arelli said, quote, Aristide is from the past. We're looking to the future. In Arizona, an environmental activist is facing 25 years in jail and a $250,000 fine for a speech he gave in San Diego 3 years ago. The government charges the activist, Rodney Coronado, broke the law by urging people to commit arson and telling them how to build an incendiary device. The FBI has described Coronado as a leader of the Earth Liberation Front. His speech came just a day after the Earth Liberation Front claimed responsibility for burning down a new condominium complex in San Diego. Coronado has never been charged in connection with the fire, just the speech he gave the next day. in China. A dissident journalist has been freed after 17 years in prison. The 38-year-old Yu Donghui was arrested in 1989 during the pro-democracy Tiananmen Square protests for hurling eggs filled with red paint at a portrait of Mao. Family members have expressed grave concerns over the state of his mental health. His brother reported Mr. Yu didn't even recognize him. Reporters Without Borders has been warning for years that Mr. Yu had gone insane as a result of being tortured in prison. And in Ohio, a private video surveillance company called City Watcher has embedded radio transmitter ID chips into two of its employees. It's believed to be the first time U.S. workers have been electronically tagged for identification purposes. Privacy activist Liz McIntyre said, quote, "There are very serious privacy and civil liberties issues of having people permanently numbered. The company has planted the electronic chip into the upper right arms of the two workers. The implants ensure that only those two employees have access to a room where the company holds security video footage for government agencies and the police. The radio frequency identification tags are made by the U.S. company Verichip. The technology allows a company or government to permanently track anyone embedded with an ID chip." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. In Iraq, at least 140 people have been killed nationwide over the past 48 hours, prompting officials and politicians to appeal for calm amid growing concerns of a slide into an all-out civil war. The violence was sparked by the bombing of the Askariya Mosque, one of the country's main Shiite shrines, in Samarra on Wednesday. In response, the government has declared an unprecedented daytime curfew for Baghdad and three nearby provinces in an effort to prevent more bloodshed, and civilian flights from Baghdad Airport have been canceled. Iraq's largest Sunni religious organization said 184 mosques have been attacked, 10 clerics killed, and another 15 abducted over the past 2 days. In the worst single incident, 47 factory workers were killed and their bodies dumped in a ditch outside Baghdad. In Bakuba, at least 16 people were killed in a suicide bomb attack at a market, and 13 bullet-riddled bodies were found Thursday night in different areas of Baghdad. 7 U.S. soldiers were also killed in 2 roadside bombings. The U.S. military has reportedly ordered soldiers in Baghdad to stay in their barracks and are, quote, watching and waiting to see what the next 48 hours will bring. This according to the New York Times.
In protest of the unrest, Sunni politicians have pulled out of emergency talks convened by the Iraqi president, Jalal Talabani. The Sunni alliance has also announced its withdrawal from negotiations to form a coalition government. In a rare public rebuke, the main Sunni religious authority, the Association of Muslim Scholars, accused Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, of fomenting the violence. Sistani has urged Shias not to attack Sunni mosques, but a spokesperson for the cleric said anger might be hard to contain. Meanwhile, Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr added his voice to those calling for restraint. He charged the Iraqi government and the U.S. have failed to protect the Askariya shrine and commanded his Mahdi army militia to guard Shia shrines throughout Iraq. Several joint Sunni-Shia demonstrations were held Friday morning in Basra, Kut, and Mosul to condemn violence and call for national unity. The staff of satellite TV channel Al Arabiya is also in mourning today, following the assassination of one of its best-known correspondents. She was 30 years old. Atwar Bajat was killed along with her cameraman and soundman. Their bodies were found Thursday near Samarra. We go now to Iraq to speak with Tom Lassiter, Baghdad correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you very much.
Can you describe what you have seen happening?
Well, over the past couple of days, there has been certainly a lot of public expressions of rage on both sides, both Sunni and Shia. You know, when word started to come out of the dome being destroyed in Samarra, there were, you know, almost immediately dozens of attacks on Sunni mosques, primarily in Baghdad. And then there were public demonstrations by Sunnis against those attacks. And people are just are very concerned about how wide the violence will spread. Things were sort of eerily quiet today because, as you mentioned, not on the road. They're mainly in their neighborhoods, which really makes the audiences for the Friday prayers a lot smaller. And I think there was trying to fail any large public protest that could spill into more massive violence.
I'd like to ask you about the role of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army. On the one hand, he's publicly called for an end to the violence. On the other hand, some Sunnis are claiming that the Mahdi army is engaged in some of the attacks.
Well, you know, Sadr and his militia fought the U.S. In April 2004 and then July and August of 2004. His stronghold is in Sadr City in eastern Baghdad, about 2.5 million people, Baghdad's largest city. And you a lot of times get very conflicting messages out of the camp, whether they're going to pursue political means or violence. And part of that is a function of Sadr City being a place really in disarray. You know, you've got millions of people in these very cramped quarters, a lot of poverty, a lot of very angry people. And so it's not at all surprising that when they heard that the zone had been destroyed, that there was a fair amount of violence in Sadr City. Guys with RPGs, AK-47s, and a lot of Sunni mosques around that area were attacked. Now, as that was happening, Sadr was out of the country. He was in Lebanon. And, you know, it's hard to gauge chain of command there. You know, were there messages from Lebanon to Sadr City that quickly saying attack these mosques? You know, it's full. But, you know, again, it's hard to gauge, you know, how much top-down command his organization has, because you're dealing with an awful lot of militia members in very chaotic settings. And certainly he has gone back and forth over the past year and a half about the sort of tactics that he's going to pursue.
Tom Lassiter, you were embedded with U.S. troops in or near Samarra?
Yes, I was in downtown Samarra for about 2 weeks.
Can you talk about your experience there and also about U.S. troops being told to stay in barracks now?
Well, Samarra is a violent place. I was there at the end of last month and the beginning of this month. It is a place that U.S. troops went into in October of 2004 as a precursor to the push into Fallujah that November. It was sort of a test case of them battering a town within the you know, often referred to as the Sunni Triangle. And you sort of fast forward to now, more than a year later, they just had to build a large dirt wall around the town. The town's lost half its population. Many of the buildings are scarred by gunfire, bombings, RPGs. The soldiers are there still, certainly when I was there, based near daily RPG attacks, grenade attacks, small arms fire, AK-47 attacks. Just very chaotic setting. It's also significant that the troops who are there with the 101st Airborne, there are far fewer of them there in Samarra than there were when the 3rd Infantry Division was there last year. It's gone from over 400 troops to about 120 troops. And so that significantly reduced their ability to go out and patrol on a regular basis in areas around that, you know, like the area around the shrine. And what's taken up some of that slack is a group of Interior Ministry commandos from Baghdad who are predominantly Shia, and there's a considerable amount of friction between them and the Sunnis in Samarra. And that had to happen because the Iraqi army and police units in Samarra were believed to be so infiltrated, corrupt, just intimidated by insurgents, that they were taken off the checkpoints around the city. There was a widely held belief that they were allowing insurgents to come in. So Samarra, just a terrifically complicated place. In terms of the U.S. In Baghdad and elsewhere in the country telling troops to invest at bases, I do not know that from my reporting today. I can tell you that there are not many troops out on the streets, but you know, their top spokesman, Major General Lynch, yesterday said that it would not affect operational tempo, but, you know, we'll just have to see. I think there's a deal of wait and see going on. Lynch certainly said that they wanted to see what the Iraqi government and the Iraqi security forces were capable of in this sort of situation. I suppose we'll all find out.
And Tom Lasseter of Knight Ridder Newspapers, your sense of how this new violence, now this new wave of violence, is going to affect the continuing attempt of the Iraqi government to establish its legitimacy following the elections, the recent elections?
I think it's a little too soon to tell. Iraq has, at several points during the past couple of years, seemed to be on the brink of chaos, of just disaster. For example, when Sadr's guys were fighting in July and August 2004, I was here at the time, covered a lot of that fighting, and it felt very much like the country was on edge. You know, and it pulled back from that violence. In 2004, during the fighting in Fallujah, again, a very chaotic time, and the nation managed in its way to hold together. But certainly, it's not so much the numbers dead, because the numbers that have been killed over the past couple of days, we've had that many killed in, a single car bombing in Iraq before, or a series of car bombings in Iraq before. It's more the open anger and rage over the sectarian divide. And if that continues, certainly it will cripple any attempts to create a government that represents Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds. If the religious and political leadership are able to rein that in and pull it back, it could actually have the opposite effect. It could signal to everyone how deeply important it is to have an inclusive government. And I think, again, we're just going to have to watch over the next couple of days at how widely spread the violence gets.
And Tom Lasseter.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Tom Lasseter, I want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Baghdad. He's the correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers and was embedded with U.S. troops in Samarra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll speak with an Iraqi blogger and architect, Raad Jarar. Stay with us.
حالفين لنعود يوم على حبكم غلطة مرت وانتهت شمعة العشرة انطفت غلطة مرت وانتهت شمعة العشرة انطفت والذنب هو ذنبكم والذنب هو ذنب تايبين للمحبة ما يرجعنا الحنين ما يرجعنا الحنين.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn now to Raad Jarar, an Iraqi blogger and architect who runs the popular blog Raad in the Middle. He is joining us from studio in San Francisco. Raad, welcome to Democracy Now! At first, your assessment of what's happening in Iraq right now.
5-4. I'm not hearing his mic.
We are having a little trouble hearing Raad. We're going to give it one more try. We'll go to a musical break, and then we'll try again. Raad Jarar will join us, blogger and architect. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. By the way, we're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country on Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And right now, Raad is in the studio at Link TV. We'll go to a musical break.
والذنب هو ذنبكم والذنب هو ذنب تايبين وللمحبة ما يرجعنا الحنين ما يرجعنا الحنين غلطة ودفعنا
أجمل أيام السنين أجمل أيام السنين تايبين وللمحبة ما يرجعنا الحنين ما يرجعنا الحنين غلطة ودفعنا ثمنها أجمل أيام السنين أجمل أيام السنين غلطة صارت.
We're going to try to go to Rar Jarar later in the program, but right now, Juan, we're going to turn to a story that you have been covering for the New York Daily News.
Yes, well, in Washington, Republican Congressman Joe Barton of Texas has launched an investigation into one of the world's major oil companies. But no, he's not investigating whether any of the oil giants are engaging in price gouging at a time when gasoline and heating oil costs are skyrocketing. Instead, Barton has set his sights on the only oil company that actually dared to lower its prices last year, at least for the poorest Americans. Last week, Barton demanded that Venezuelan-owned Citgo produce all records, minutes, logs, emails, even desk calendars related to the company's novel program of supplying discounted heating oil to low-income communities in the United States. The Citgo program, which began late last year in Massachusetts and the South Bronx, provides oil at discounts as high as 60% off market price.
To discuss this, we'll be joined in a few minutes by New York Congressmember Jose Serrano. But first, we're going to turn to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He first announced the discounted gas program during an interview on Democracy Now! When we went to the Venezuelan ambassador's home, the ambassador to the United Nations in New York, and interviewed the Venezuelan president.
After many meetings with the U.S. citizens, we decided to propose a scheme for poor populations and low-income populations in the U.S. We've seen that poverty in the U.S. is growing everywhere. It's close to 11% poverty, according to some estimates. And instead of the figures, you have to go deeper into it. Because if you see Katrina and you saw what's happened, 100,000 people were abandoned, and they are abandoned, and they're just surviving. So here we have Citgo, this oil company. We have the Citgo company here in the United States. This is a Venezuelan company. So let's have a look at the U.S. map, the distribution area of Citgo in the U.S. We are present in 14,000 gas stations in the U.S. And here we have different refineries, asphalt refineries, 8 refineries that we have in the U.S. The plants for filling units, the third refineries, terminals, and so on. We want to use these infrastructures to help the poor populations. We have made some progress. We have given instructions to the president of Citgo, Felix Rodriguez. We want that up to 10% we refine here. We supply every day to the U.S. 1.5 million barrels of oil, crude and product. And we refine here close to 800,000 barrels a day, refined here in the U.S. So we would like to take 10% of what we refine, those products, and to offer these products in several modalities to the poor populations. And the pilot project will be starting in Chicago. We are already operating in Chicago. Well, let's hope that there's not going to be any obstacle by the government opposed to this project being implemented, but we will be working in those poor populations. We have some allies.
That was Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez speaking to Democracy Now! Last September when Juan and I interviewed him. Now joining us on the telephone is Democratic Congressmember Jose Serrano of New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Serrano.
Thank you for your invitation, and good morning to both.
Can you explain what Joe Barton, the energy Congress member from Texas, is doing? What is he calling for?
I think they're being obscene. There's no other way to describe it. I mean, for years, we've begged Congress to look at the oil companies, and now I may have to put on my resume that with a program that helps the poor, we've been able to get Congress to finally look at an oil company, except that they're looking at the wrong one, and for the wrong reasons. This is blatantly political to ask if the program is here to serve the poor or it's part of a larger political agenda, which was part of what the letter said. I think what's happening, and it's obvious to me, that the oil companies are embarrassed, and they are asking their friends in Congress, mostly Republicans. And as you guys know, I try when I'm on this show to be as non-political as possible. But there's no other way to put it. The Bush administration has a serious problem with President Hugo Chavez. They don't like the success he's having both in his country and throughout Latin America. They don't like what's happening in terms of governments moving to the left. So they've made him the demon that they have to destroy. And now when he pulls off something that is helping people in my community, in Boston, Chicago, in Maine and Vermont and other places, Rhode Island, it's spreading throughout the country, they're going to now start to investigate and harass them. And that's what it's all about.
Well, I called Congressman Joe Barton's office earlier this week to ask what prompted this, and the response of the chief of staff of the House Energy Committee was that Hugo Chavez was interfering in U.S. in the United States government oil policy, and that therefore they wanted to investigate whether there was actually some antitrust violations occurring. Your response?
Well, I think the only thing he's interfering in, and CITGO, is in the usual ripoff of the poor and the working class by the oil companies in this country. As you know, their profits have been outrageous, and no one is looking at that. They were asked by members of the Senate to do something. They totally ignored it. CITGO was the only one that stepped up. And I think this goes into some dangerous grounds here because, for instance, when they ask for logs, phone conversations, and so on, which they're asking voluntarily now, and they may go and try to do it in an official subpoena way. What are they saying? That they also want minutes of any meetings that I had with CITGO, that Joe Kennedy had with CITGO, that Bernie Sanders had with CITGO, and other members of Congress, Charlie Rangel, Gregory Meeks? Well, that goes into a dangerous area because they're not investigating serious ethics violations in Congress, and here they're going to try to find out what kind of conversations we had. But the conversations are public. They were basically a great program that we were all trying to get in our communities. And I tell you, if with all due respect to my colleagues, I'm not going to give out names, but if I give you the list for about 60 members of Congress from all parts of the country who are asking me, can I set up a meeting with CITGO to see if they can get this kind of program in their district?
Now, Congressman Joe Barton, of course, has a long record of defending oil industry interests at least of the major oil companies in Congress. He's also, as I noted in my column, in the last election cycle, received more money than anyone else in Congress except Tom DeLay from the oil industry, and has received over $2 million in the 20 years he's been in Congress from the oil and electric utility industry. Your assessment of his role as chair of the Energy Committee.
And we should say, by the way, we did invite Congressman Barton to be on the program, and he declined.
Well, you know, I don't do too much analysis of where folks may get their the campaign contributions, because in many cases it doesn't sway in any way. But what is bad here is that it doesn't, you don't have to really do too much analysis to realize that Katrina, that the oil crisis this winter, that all the things that could be looked at in terms of the oil companies in this country are not being looked at. And then this whole gripe with President Chavez and following on the heels of Condoleezza Rice once again trying to undo what Chavez is doing in Latin America by now suggesting that she's going to go, and she said this publicly, on behalf of the administration to different countries in Latin America to try to create a front against Hugo Chavez. Well, this is what just sticks out as a sore thumb. It's sickening. So I rather just continue to look at why, how, not why, we know why, but how can the Republicans get away with singling out one oil company and not looking at their profits, interestingly enough, not looking at how much they've been charging Americans, but looking at why they discounted their oil up to 60%, as you said, and why are they giving help to the poor? I mean, it's ridiculous, and I think this time it may backfire because it's not just the South Bronx or eventually Harlem or East Harlem. It's a homeowner communities composed of working class and senior citizen white folks throughout this country who are benefiting from this program, and they're going to scratch their head and say, I don't get it. Why are you going after these guys and not the other guys?
Congressmember Sedano, we want to switch gears for a moment and ask you about what's happening in Puerto Rico with the FBI sweep that was launched last week. They say to prevent a, quote, domestic terrorist attack. You've held a news conference on this issue. Are they using these sweeps as a guise for something else? Is there a real threat here?
I think there's a real threat. You know, one of the things I said at that Speak Out Forum, the Dash press conference, was that just at the time when I was able to get the FBI to release, and they've released so far 155,000 files on the whole Puerto Rican independence movement, just when that is beginning to happen, we are now in a situation where I'm sure that 5-10 years from now we'll be on this show again talking about releasing the current files since September 11th. Because it seems that the FBI is taking September 11th, like most federal agencies, and using it as an excuse to go after people. The problem is that now they claim that it's part of terrorism. Last week, the subcommittee that I sit on, an Appropriations Committee, Homeland Security, I asked the director, Chertoff, I said, if the attacks in Puerto Rico, the sweep, was related to terrorism, then you were involved, right? You know something? Not that this shocks anybody about this particular gentleman. He claims he had no knowledge that the FBI was claiming that this was terrorism related. And it wasn't, because as you know, a few hours later, they dropped the terrorism comments. They dropped the fear of a terrorist attack comments. And now they can't explain why they swept through Puerto Rico and attacked all of these homes and created this situation. The problem they committed this time, the mistake they made, is they went after some folks in your profession. As you know, there is live videotape that shows the amazing of journalists who were trying to get the story, and the FBI was just spraying them and creating havoc. And so most of what is happening in Puerto Rico right now, interestingly enough, is politicians defending the press and asking questions about the press, and that's historic because we politicians never defend the press.
And your reference earlier to the files that were released by the FBI, that's the files of the FBI's persecution of and surveillance of independence supporters over decades, right?
Absolutely, which you reported at Juan, after you came to our office and looked at these files. Now, two files are given at all times. One file is given to my office, and two are given to my office. I send one to the Puerto Rico Senate, and they claim that they're doing something with it. I'm not sure what, but they will be giving it at least to some of the institutions down there to look at. Then my personal file, I have no use for, I give to El Centro at Hunter College. They have a website where they're exposing these things, and people are being able to go online and analyze them. And, you know, one of the interesting things and ironic is that during that period of time, then-Governor Luis Muñoz Marín thought that he was doing a great service to the people of Puerto Rico by helping the FBI with some of these missions, if you will, only to find out in these files, as you found out, that during that period of time, the FBI was surveilling him and trying to discredit him while he was trying to help them perhaps discredit other people.
Congressmember Sedano, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Democratic Congressmember of New York. And this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we are joined in the studio in San Francisco now by Raed Jarar, who is a well-known Iraqi blogger and architect. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's good to hear your voice. Can you talk about the situation right now in Iraq?
Yeah. The situation in Iraq, especially after this explosion, is very tense and I can understand the Western media concern with what's happening in Iraq, but I can't understand this celebration of what's happening. Yesterday, I was searching for how many news stories were written about this explosion that contains the word civil war in the last 24 hours, and I found more than 1,000 stories in through Google that says that there is a civil war that will start in Iraq. So let me put things in context before I say what I think about the explosion per se. One of the main differences between the Iraqi Sunnis and Shia, and Sunnis and Shia in general, is the way that they deal with the sons and grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad. For Shia, they respect them so much, so they build big shrines for them and they go visit them, especially the 12 direct grandsons from the Prophet Muhammad. These 12 grandsons have big shrines with gold around them and stuff. And it happened that some of the times these shrines exist in Sunni cities or like Sunni majority cities, like the city of Samarra. And this, like here, the irony of this explosion happens. The shrine that is in Samarra that contains the three bodies of the last the last three imams was actually controlled by Sunnis and claimed by Sunnis. The people who run the shrine are Sunnis, and Samarra is a unique case in the Iraqi history where there are Sunnis that claim that they are grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad, and they call themselves Sayyid, the same word that the Shia call themselves. So the shrine is not threatened by Sunnis at all, and like all of the Sunnis, whether they were Sayyid or not, will be respecting it because these are the places of the grandsons of the Prophet. The irony is that the Imam al-Askari himself said something before he died. He said, "My tomb or my shrine in Samarra will be a refuge for both Shia and Sunnis in the future." So this just reflects the level of integration between the two different ethnicities inside Samarra. Unfortunately, what happened in Iraq after the invasion is that the U.S. administration and the media there was telling Iraqis for the last 2 or 3 years that they are not Iraqis, that they are Sunnis and Shia, that they are trying to invest in this segments inside the Iraqi community to control the country. Or, it reminds me of the same way that the former Syrian president, senior al-Assad president was controlling Lebanon, of supporting different or shifting support from different ethnic groups to make sure that no one is winning. So what's happening in Iraq now is that when after the invasion, the U.S. Forces used to support.
We lost that feed with Raad Jarar, Iraqi blogger and architect, speaking to us. His well-known popular blog is called Raad in the Middle. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we turn now to response to the situation in Iraq, to the occupation, to Danny Schechter, the news dissector, veteran journalist, media critic, and co-founder of MediaChannel.org, the world's largest online media issues network. It's launched a Tell the Truth About the War campaign, calling for better and more consistent coverage of the Iraq War. It's partnering with other media groups to organize a Media Day of War protest on March 21st. It'll take part during a week of organizing and activism marking the third anniversary of the invasion. Danny Schechter writes, if the war is to end, the coverage has to change. We need to press the press and move the media. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Of course, this has been your message for a long time. You're not just protesting the media. You're actually offering a perspective that's not in the media most of the time, which is why I think so many people watch your program. But beyond that, we have to take media seriously as an issue. And I'm really delighted that the coalition, the United for Peace and Justice Coalition, which has been focused on anti-war activity, which is focused mostly on the government role, is now shifting a bit and is opening up to the critique of the media and has designated a day on March 21st as a media protest day worldwide. And we are trying to get activists in every city in the country, as well as in the rest of the world, to take the media seriously, challenge media coverage, meet with the media if you can. What do you think, Juan? Could we get into the Daily News and meet with some of the executives there?
I'm sure that that an appointment can be arranged with the editorial board. I don't know how much success you'll have in changing the position, but I think it's definitely something that would make them stand up and take notice.
The last time I was with your publisher, Mort, years ago, we both played the game Class Struggle, and unfortunately he won. But I want a rematch, and I'd like to talk with him again. The idea is engage the media on one level, challenge them, talk to them, not just denounce them. On the other hand, protest institutionally at media outlets. And we're going to do it in New York with a mobile protest. We hope to have a candlelight vigil at the networks on March 21st while the newscasts are underway. Hopefully maybe an event the night before. We haven't organized all the details, but United for Peace and Justice, Leslie Kagan, coordinator, is very thrilled about this, as we are, because we think that you couldn't have had this war in Iraq without the media supporting it and selling it the way it did. And that's why I made the movie WMD and have written a new book, When News Lies, to try to focus on this issue.
We're going to go to an excerpt of that movie in just a minute. But I want to ask you about right now what journalists are facing in Iraq. Learning about the Al Arabiya reporter, 30-year-old woman, her two crew, cameramen and soundmen who were just killed. Jill Carroll remains kidnapped.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of our demands also, to release not only kidnapped journalists, but journalists who've been jailed by U.S. authorities without any charges being filed against them, without any information being provided about why they're being arrested, no due process whatsoever. The International Federation of Journalists has raised this issue. It's an issue that we all should take seriously because it's the fight for the right to know. It's the fight for information. And the journalists on the front line are in a very dangerous situation, more journalists dead in Iraq than in the entire Vietnam War. And this is something we have to take seriously. The woman who just died from Al Arabiya was an Al Jazeera correspondent before that. You know, very, very brave reporter, very popular reporter. And for her to be killed, and we don't know who's doing this. You know, this
is Bajat. She was just heading into Samarra.
Yeah, we don't know who's behind all this.
The reports were that those that killed her shouted out, "We want the correspondent, the correspondent." She was Iraqi herself, from a Sunni Shia family.
So they basically want to keep us in the dark about what's happening in Iraq. That's why the coverage has, you know, it's become when it bleeds, it leads. There's very little analysis and background and context being offered that helps people get a perspective about the complete failure of the U.S. intervention there.
And Danny, as somebody who has been monitoring this coverage now on a regular basis, your sense, has there been any impact or change in any of the corporate media as a result of how badly the war has gone?
Well, I think because as public opinion has shifted against the war, media doesn't want to alienate it, what customers it has left. So they want to try to appear to be a little bit more balanced. When people like John Murther speak out, they can't ignore it. So there has been some shift in the media coverage, but basically they've been locked into, you know, justifying this intervention. First they justified the invasion. Now they're saying, well, withdrawal can't work. You know, they're raising a blizzard of questions about why nothing can be done about the situation.
Danny, we want to turn for a few minutes to your film. It's called WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception.
The President will address the nation at 10:15.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Level of protection would be minimal, and if I were a news president or a news executive right now, I would be pulling my people out.
When the war had finally begun, the networks began pulling their reporters out of Baghdad. Peter Arnett was in the Iraqi capital with a National Geographic documentary team. He decided to stay.
Covering wars are a dangerous business. You can die, and there's companies feel responsible for their people in harm's way. They sometimes order them out.
I think there is something to be said for staying. However, from a news executive standpoint, the risks are enormous.
You know, I sort of have a genetic tick that allows me to go into dangerous areas without too much concern.
The interesting thing was is that the American military were trying to intimidate these journalists. They were saying, you know, you're going to be a target and everything. And the journalists were working overtime to say, look, we're here, this is our coordinates, don't fire. And everybody knew that journalists were at these hotels. That's why they were at these hotels. It was also known that if you're going to have shock and awe, you need somebody to record it. I mean, the one thing that they left out was they needed the media to fight this war. The war was set up to be filmed and recorded by the media. So there was this bizarre symbiotic relationship.
Action to begin. CBS's David Martin at the Pentagon is following the planning and has the latest on a possible timeline.
To promote its war, the Pentagon made media management a priority. Their strategy was sophisticated, clever, and almost always covert. Few media outlets exposed it. Most participated willingly for their own political and economic reasons. Pentagon's strategy went beyond traditional PR, using marketing strategies and perception management. Administration officials likened their war planning to a product rollout. It was all to guarantee there would be only one storyline in the media and in the minds of Americans, theirs. A Pentagon advisor told me it was intentional. They knew that TV networks prefer storytelling to sloganizing. Their storyline became a master narrative, defining Iraq as the problem and U.S. military intervention as the only solution. Traditionally, propaganda is targeted at the enemy. In this war, it was smoothly infiltrated into the news, aimed at American and global public opinion.
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
This platform is not a platform for propaganda. This is a platform for truth.
In his war plan, Tommy Franks, the U.S. military commander, described the press, once known as the Fourth Estate, as the Fourth Front. He knew that a supportive media was essential for victory, and he cultivated one.
This will be a campaign unlike any other in history.
The Pentagon focused on winning the media war, leaking their plan to reporters they could trust.
We knew the plan, and I think the military benefited as far as positive coverage during the war because we knew what the plan was. So we reported that things basically were on plan, or we weren't worried when we got delayed 2 or 3 days because we knew overall it was very successful.
Earlier, when the media pressed for access, Frank's team came up with the idea of embedding reporters. A former corporate PR professional turned Pentagon official ran the program.
One of the things we did, it wasn't rocket science, but it was hard work. We took the same kind of planning and training and discipline that you put into military operations and put it into this aspect of the military operations. And Rumsfeld and Myers, being enlightened guys, had included people like me in the war planning from the very earliest stages.
But Tory Clark got major networks and news organizations to sign a 12-page contract agreeing to certain ground rules that actually kept the Department of Defense, public affairs people in the driver's seat. And you got reporters in with these young, idealistic troops who really believed all the spin of what was going on. We were going to liberate Iraq, that the reporters would overall identify with the troops and their reporting would be very positive.
I'm on the journey, but when we get there, any sort of incident happens, please keep calm and remain on the bus. We will deal with the situation, no matter what it is, as swiftly as possible.
Excerpt of WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception. Danny Schechter, the news dissector, final comment.
Yeah, this film is now in a book called When News Lies. It's packaged with the script and with the whole story of what happens when you challenge the media paradigm, what our experience was in trying to get this film out worldwide, the fight we had to get it on the air in America and in other countries. The book is When News Lies from Select Books, and that's part of our effort to raise these issues. And not only that, a new book, The Death of the Media, which is trying to talk about how we can change the media.
Danny Schechter, we want to thank you very much for being with us as we turn now to the political firestorm that has both Democrats and Republicans in a fierce clash with the White House. At the center is the deal between two foreign companies, British firm P&O and Dubai Ports World of United Arab Emirates, the agreement to turn over some terminal operations of 6 major U.S. seaports to Dubai Port World, including New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Miami, and New Orleans. Late Thursday night, Dubai Ports World offered to delay the multi-million dollar deal after the White House reportedly signaled it would welcome such a move. In our last minute of the broadcast, we are joined by CorpWatch.org's Prothap Chatterjee, who has written a fascinating piece on this issue. Can you talk about the significance of this controversy right now, Prothap?
Well, Amy, Dubai is a central military hub for the war on terrorism, and it is the second busiest sea airport in the world after Seattle. This is an essential stopping point for aircraft carriers like the USS JFK. This is the key place where companies like Halliburton ship personnel and military equipment into Iraq and Afghanistan. More flights leave from Dubai, more equipment arriving by sea from the Houston seaports of Corpus Christi and Beaumont, both controlled by P&O, arrive into the port of Jebel Ali. And this is why this is so critical. It's about the war on terrorism. It's about business. And this is the most key thing. It is not about whether or not it is an Arab company. It's about supporting the war on terrorism is why it is essential. It's like the Hillary Clinton asking the U.S. government to stop doing business with Aramco, with the Saudi Arabian oil company, because they're Arabs. The U.S. government simply won't do it. It's about the military. It's about business. And every day, hundreds of people fly through Dubai, tons of cargo arrive in there and go out to Iraq on a daily basis. I myself was there a month ago in the port tracking this, and this is the probably one of the most important military hubs, and it is controlled by the state of Dubai, as is the company Dubai Ports World.
Prothap, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us, Managing Director of CorpWatch.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Dukadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.